Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And there's always things within the pornographic news cycle that could just easily pull us into the examining of the, what Jerry Doyle would call the grapefruit. may Jerry Doyle, rest in peace, because he passed away a while ago. But he was a talk show host, and I think he was out of the Vegas area. And his whole message, and I think he was somehow into Hollywood. I don't know his full bio, but he made one observation that, you know, if it comes from somebody else, I'll bring it up. And as a matter of fact, I've been mentioning to some people about Mordor. And as a matter of fact, I don't think I've said it on the air in a long time, but Mike Church is the guy that always referred to, at least I dub him because he was the first person to create the connection that Washington, D.C. is Mordor on the Potomac. And so he's a pretty profound conservative entertainer. And as a matter of fact, he really does dive into, but it's not all about the Constitution with him, but he does dive into the Constitution or history and those types of things. And I have to actually applaud him on, you know, his spirit of 1798 and so forth. And he's helped people kind of awaken to the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Unfortunately, he's kind of deferred to Tom Woods and Tom Woods' academic research on it because it's very limited, because Tom Woods is actually purporting the perversion that Madison was doing everything he could to stop, this perversion of single state nullification, that states could just nullify and stay in the union. They can't do that. And so anyway, so we could easily get caught up in the news cycle back to Jerry Doyle, and we could easily get caught up in examining the story. The story itself is the grapefruit. There's lots of grapefruits out there, and what ends up happening in the pornographic news cycle with all the conservative entertainers, they all take the hot issue that you want to hear about, because they're there doing this for you. Because you demand entertainment, and they want to show you the other side of that grapefruit. Or maybe they want to show you where the stem was, or and they'll get into the details of the grapefruit. And they'll analyze, and they'll try to run down all the bio information of the making of that grapefruit. It's, you know, its tree, its origins. And he made such a profound point on this, that how, you know, the story itself may be tragic or what have you. It's kind of like one can sit there and watch and go through a plethora of videos or, you know, in social media, reels, what have you. You could literally waste your entire time. And I know people that have a real problem with social media, where they just, you know, the next thing you know, they sit down and they start, you know, flying through reels, and they've been sitting there watching that or doing that for hours a day. Can't you do something more productive? And I believe most people on this show, listening to this show, are doing something more productive. But what more can you do? Have you gotten involved? Have you started petitioning? Have you started getting engaged? Have you started educating your neighbors, those people down the street? Maybe those people that you may not feel comfortable with, or actually, you've actually come at odds. You maybe had a point of contention with somebody in the neighborhood. You know, you can always start the conversation off to say, you know, look, we have every legal right to not like each other, but we have more in common than maybe we're willing to admit. But it's more important that we start putting our differences aside and start working together. Now, I understand there is such, you know, there are people that create such animosity, such contention, that it's just hard to get past that. Don't make your life's work just trying to get one person to like you. As a matter of fact, sometimes you have to accept the fact that that person is going to be that way, but we have to take the higher ground. And believe you me, it's tough. I know. I'm one who does not want to be a hypocrite, so I will tell you, I know it's tough because I have a hard time with it. I know it's tough when you've got contention with a neighbor, a direct neighbor, or somebody just down the street because they're dogs, they're kids. It doesn't matter. There's always somebody. We have to humble ourselves. We have to get to the higher ground so that we can actually help unite people. And what we have to do is we have to have either the difficult conversation, or at least we have to start, you know, working around the problem and be there welcoming with arms of, you know, let's just say forgiveness or indifference of the problems and contention, and say, you know what, that's not important right now. What's important is that government is going to get ready to seize more, if not all, and do the final seizure of your liberties. You think it's bad now, it is only going to get worse. And, you know, folks, I can't do justice to the worst that I'm speaking of. Hollywood, with all of the technology and the way they can manipulate all sorts of things and manufacture with deep fake everything, Hollywood cannot do the level of worse. It's going to get so worse. They can't do that justice. I can't do it justice in describing it. So what makes you, because we're talking a biblical proportion of worse. You know, let's just think about some of the things in the Old Testament with Isaiah and Baal and, you know, the offerings of fire coming from the sky and just licking up the water and licking up their sacrifice. Folks, when it comes to, you know, how bad or how worse it's going to get, I think what really matters is that, one, you're doing what you really need to be doing in supporting and defending liberty. Most people go, well, why? Why? And I'm not telling you to stop a proselyte. I'm not telling you to stop going to church. I'm not telling you to stop doing those spiritual things that every one of us needs to do. Say your prayers, read your scriptures, do those things. But there's no doubt in my mind, our Creator wants all people to enjoy liberty so that they can make the choice for themselves. This line we are going to cross will literally take you to a point where you will not be able to cross that line anymore. There will become a point in time where a proselyting will not be allowed. And as a matter of fact, there will only be one religion. You know, some of the things that a lot of people don't learn, you know, is just, you know, this concept of communism, statism, that goes all the way back to Plato. Dante wrote a book, and I believe it was called Demarchia. This is in my first book. And most people don't even know that Dante was basically banished. I mean, he was blackballed by the church because of that book. Because that book actually, I believe, that was the book that spoke to unifying the world into a single government, into a single religion. And, you know, Dante didn't see how that was such a bad thing. Well, at that point in time, folks, people didn't have the scriptures. People didn't know what was in the scriptures, and the church knew what was in the scriptures. And the people in the church go, oh, you know, that's the evilest of times. And so they basically banished him for basically portraying what Revelations portrayed. And he got back into the graces of the church. But my point is that it's going to get that bad. It's not going to be good. I mean, there's lots of people that are doing everything they can to hedge their bets, to basically prepare, to put aside, what have you. Just know this, that in Matthew 24, Christ says that for his elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So when we talk about what we need to do, you know, you hear me going through the Constitution. Now, I told you what we were going to get into is we're going to get into Billy Graham's commitment. So if I don't get to that today, if I don't get into the scale of liberty today, then I'm going to just carry that through into tomorrow's episode because it's all really, really important. But what I wanted to do, I am so blessed with such great people I work with. I can't imagine how they couldn't be that great. People that actually hear, not my words, but hear the words. And all I am is a medium. I'm a vehicle in helping people hear the truth out of the ratification debates and from the framers. These critical points in time so that you can kind of hear what was being said, what was being done, and the whole lack of the powers, the whole lack of the authority for the federal government in doing some of the things like the Assumption Act and so forth, and how they executed the Whiskey Rebellion. And so in ways, you know, there's no doubt we are in the opportune point in time in looking at the truth. As I tell many people, when we look at the truth is what those men were saying and what they were arguing at the time that it happened. Because, you know, there's lots of people editorializing what happened afterwards. And yours truly, I can editorialize. I can tell you what my views are based on what I've read and how I've connected all the dots. Because that's kind of what most... I guess we can call ourselves oracles. You know, there's people out there that, you know, have done a lot of research, and based on their research, you know, they've come to these conclusions. Unfortunately, that most people are at a great disadvantage. So one of the things I told you I had to do, and since we finished, and it's actually up, the petition that goes after the courts and even the executives for trying to legislate, trying to create law without the authority to do that. Now, I guess the next thing we need to do is, I don't think so. I think that this actually covers it because... Bottom line, and when I get into the medical freedom, when we wrap that thing up, that's not far away, folks. Getting the medical freedom done, I'm really trying to do the best we possibly can in articulating the point that there is no reason why the federal government should have ever had sat in the room, or I should say the federal courts should never have opened their doors to the Obamacare. This should have actually been the states getting together and basically saying, you can't do this, and interposing. Bottom line, can the states do that? Yes, the states can do that one at a time. What that process is called is republic review. So understanding these few things, and this is not rocket science. But understanding the Constitution in the way I will tell you this is how you have to do it, if you do it this way, then all of a sudden your view of the Constitution and the federal government, their roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties, you know, become far more clear. The resolutions of 1798, now I'm just hopping around a little bit, just kind of giving you some, you know, like a prelude here. The resolutions of 1798 were literally points in time, was a point in time, and actually it's two points in time, when Kentucky stood up and said the federal government doesn't have these authorities, and Thomas Jefferson audited the Constitution and identified what authorities they didn't have and how these very specific four laws violated the Constitution. Then the next point in time is Virginia responded in kind, and basically Jefferson called for all the states to join together to create this tribunal. He didn't use the words interposition, but nor did he use the words nullification. He said, we need to meet with committees of correspondence so that we can actually start discussing what we're going to do. Now, Madison in kind comes back and basically agrees and says, not only that, but this, we're not only supposed to, you know, meet, we're obligated to meet as the parties of the compact. And that right there is the key. The parties of the compact are to create that great tribunal. So when we talk to people, when I talk, and I encourage you to talk to people that are focused on the Constitution in a myopic view, a lot of times, you know, and a large preponderance of those people that have a very myopic view, in other words, one of the largest movements regarding the Constitution are the Second Amendment folks. And they will tell you that this is the most important part of the Constitution. And in so doing, they basically just say it's about guns, defense, and force. The Constitution is nothing like about guns, defense, and force. And as a matter of fact, it's not that it's not important because it's a part of the Constitution, but it's important because it's a part of the Constitution. In other words, when you focus on the one little line in that Constitution, and as a matter of fact, the Second Amendment isn't the right to bear arms. It basically states the importance of a well-regulated militia for a secure and free state. The right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So, in other words, it is important that we, the people, be a part of a militia. And because of that, you will always maintain this right to bear arms. You have to function in the militia. This is kind of like a mandate, folks, that we all have to be a part of a militia. This goes in line with Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 that says Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the land, the laws of the Union, and to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. So this goes back to what is the most important part is if it's not the Second Amendment, because the Second Amendment kind of has a lot of different little ties in other parts of the Constitution, and it's not the freedom of religion or the freedom of speech, I will tell you that the one thing that's hidden, that's integral to the most important part of our contract and constitutional law is the First Amendment right of petition for the redress of grievances. Ah, but that's not the most important part of the Constitution. What is the most important part of the Constitution? Now, this may seem subjective, but as I've looked at how Madison focuses on these principles, he never says anything about Article 7. Thomas Jefferson doesn't, but the way they focus on this, on these principles, it's about first understanding the Constitution. What part of the Constitution will actually create the pure clarity of what the Constitution is? Article 7. Article 7 clearly requires that the states must ratify. So what does that mean? That means that this is a compact, treaty, contract, because ratification is the process of accepting a compact. And what this does in the ratification process is it gets the state to completely buy into the compact, to say, we are going to become a part of this compact, we're going to be a party to this, and we're going to empower this to be able to function and serve us in these very specific ways. Article 7 and this concept of the compact clearly helps you start understanding, folks, that constitutional law is nothing but we the people enforcing the compact at the different levels of government. Now, the federal government is not the all-supreme government. And we the people have really failed in really clarifying the all-supreme government. Because when you read the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence clearly states that governments are instituted by men, or we the people, for very specific purposes. And so when we went down this path a long time ago in forging this Constitution, the one thing that everybody marginalized was the most important government of all, your counties. And so when we institute government, do we just, you know, snap it together and go, okay, there you go, you're fine, that's all you need? Well, maybe so, but down the road, we're going to find out that governments that are our government, our most important government, our closest, our most precious government, our county government, is going to become marginalized and trodden underfoot. And it will become nothing but an administrative body. And that is not the intent of this Republican form of government. That all the political energy, all of the energy of government itself should reside within your, basically within your county. See, the states were really jealous. And at that point in time, the states basically went from a charter to an independent state and or sovereign state, what have you. So they didn't even clean up their act. They didn't clean up their act because they didn't see the need. They didn't see government actually becoming anything more than just, you know, a facilitator of commerce, you know, a facilitator of an economy or a currency and a standardization of the economy, those types of things. I mean, just general services. And so we didn't see the county becoming more and more integral in our lives. But we sure saw the state government, and when we created the federal government, we sure saw the state government as really important because it was the states that created that federal government. So as we kind of start peeling this apart and we start peeling the onion, now we can really start seeing where we really went wrong, because what we didn't do, we were smart enough to create a constitution for our state, but we gave them, you know, too many powers. Well, we gave them essential powers, but they have way too much power today. And that's because we never empowered in the instituting of our own counties. We never empowered them with these fundamental clauses that all powers not delegated to the state are reserved to the counties and the people respectively. These very fundamental principles of controlling government were never applied as we started growing. So this is why we see how the most energetic government that we have, our county government, the government that is actually supposed to be affecting our everyday life, and it actually does. Even in the administrative state, it is affecting our life. They're taking away things they have no authority to do, and we can't stop it until we take our counties back. Now, I'm going to dive into, because before I, you know, got going through the weekend and last Friday, I started taking time. So before I sat down to record this show, I did the due diligence in pulling in Reynolds v. Sims and the earlier case, Baker v. Carr, and how they attacked counties. The problem was that even though the states may have made the counties kind of significant in the very beginning, or at least all the new states that joined the union, they didn't understand certain things, and this is why it was easy for them to actually, with a sleight of hand, convince us that they were able to, you know, reconfigure and come in and take controls when they don't. And this is why we'll get into this, because we got to go into the mechanics of a constitution and this hybrid constitutional republic and what we need to do to actually appropriately distribute power the way it should be. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we're going into break, I was basically laying out that we have to properly distribute powers through the different levels of government. We never did that at the county level. Can we do that? Yes, we can. We can actually create county constitutions. And within those county constitutions, we should actually, you know, identify the powers that we want to give that county government. Do we want the county government to basically have a control? Now, so let's look at the different counties that we have throughout the states. Many counties may not have hospitals. In ultra-rural areas, you may have only, I have no idea how many hospitals. They may have clinics and so forth, but there may be counties that are really sparsely supported. So you may want to actually have the controls of your healthcare system at the county level and delegate few powers to the state to be able to ensure that there is at least an appropriate level of support for health and life. We do not want the state to be able to make decisions. We want all of those types of decisions to be made at the county level. So we have to reserve those things carefully to the county and or to the people. Because so conversely, when we look at a really, really populated LA County, well, there are so many people in LA County. LA County should actually be broken down into sub-districts if it doesn't make sense to break LA County down into other counties. In other words, there's no reason why you can't have other counties with, you know, to take LA County and just start subdividing it so that those people who really feel like, because I'm not even looking at LA County, but I've used it a lot. So I'm going to actually look at LA County. So let me pull up Opera, and because I use Opera, you know, a lot for very specific reasons. And so going to LA County map, just looking it up. And so, you know, I know a lot of conservative entertainers already have this. But when I look at LA County and I, you know, zoom in on it and I go, huh, so LA County actually goes all the way up to Lancaster. So in other words, if you're familiar with the LA area, you've got the foothills, the Angeles National Forest, just to the north of LA. And so you have a very large area called Lancaster, Palmdale, Lake Los Angeles, and the mountain regions. Santa Clarita is another part of this. Could that whole area be broken away into its own county? Easily, absolutely. Lancaster, there's plenty of people that live in that area today. Then you could easily subdivide down, to, or I should say the Los Angeles area, into other counties, such as the, you could have the western county that takes you all the way over to Pomona, you know, from Pasadena, maybe down to Fullerton, you know, that little triangle there. There's ways to actually subdivide LA County. The same thing with New York. The city of New York could easily be subdivided into counties to where now you have a more manageable area for people to govern themselves. In so doing, you can restore, because here's what happens, and this is the problem when government does reapportioning, and the reason I'm really getting into all of this theory stuff, because I was telling you about Reynolds v. Sims and the earlier case, Baker v. Carr. Folks, when you look at the case, and when you look at this on the face of it, and we look at how the courts, how did this creep into the courts? How did this case, the very first case was about apportionment. There was a lawsuit saying that they are, you know, apportioning, they're gerrymandering. And so the federal government got involved in the gerrymandering case. And if you really look at it, how is it that apportionment of a state and how a state decides to apportion itself is a federal jurisdiction matter? How is that? Oh, well, when it comes to congressional districts, then that becomes, because apportionment is based on the Constitution. But how is it that the state apportionment is a federal court issue? It's not. They're divided and they're separated. So it's one thing to basically, because the congressional standard for the House of Representatives is based on population. And so one of the things that Eldridge Gerry, so it should be called gerrymandering, not gerrymandering, but Eldridge Gerry went down the path of trying to carve these districts, and actually Patrick Henry was the real culprit in doing this. And the reason why I think Madison said, okay, all right, you know, we'll dive into this, was due to the fact that he was affected adversely by Patrick Henry. And it actually had I don't know if it had a negative impact between him and Moreau, because they seemed to get over, you know, the contention. As a matter of fact, they campaigned together. And I'm going, you know, I know that Monroe didn't like being pitted against Madison. And I know that there was this realistic competition. But realistically, when we look at the federal government stepping in, it's one thing to say, hey, you can't start carving population centers that, you know, provide a favor for a political outcome one way or the other. But to be honest with you, the political outcome, one way or the other, is not something that's within the jurisdiction of the court. You know, and when you start looking, oh, well, okay, now we're looking at race. Okay, so today apportionment is really driven by racial boundaries. Oh, well, these are black communities, these are Hispanic communities, Asian communities, and they start using the race. But here's the other problem. Where does the federal government have the authority over the racial influence or the racial outcome or the political association to race? It's not there. As long as the boundary. So here's the problem, folks. Your state could, and your state should have laws. If you want to have apportionment done so that it is done representative, or it is done in a way that doesn't create advantages, good luck. But when it comes to politics, and it's not that it can't be done, but good luck. Because when it comes to politics, there's always something we'll find to divide ourselves and some ways to try to create advantages. And that is the nature of politics and politicians all the time. The problem really isn't the apportionment and the dividing. The problem really is when people start creating advantages for unconstitutional reasons or for the wrong reasons, period. When we look at government that doesn't have the power to give you anything, then what does it matter? Really, what does it matter if they're being constrained to the Constitution? What does it matter? Does it really matter what the race of that or the gender of that person? Race, gender, age? It shouldn't matter. But if it's something that we're looking for kickbacks, and we want to defend our right to a kickback, well, hold on. You have no constitutional right to a kickback. This is where we become the problem. So, diving back into counties, this is where we can actually start reframing things. And this is where we can actually start realizing, because I truly see, and I'm okay with, states becoming, you know, racially divided, cities becoming racially divided, if that's what they want. But bottom line, under the Constitution, and if you make the Constitution in such a way that it doesn't matter if you're racially divided, you can't have an advantage over anybody else, period. No county can have a disparate advantage. They can't create economic advantages or disadvantages. If we actually make the law and the Constitution really is colorblind, it's genderblind, it only does the essential stuff in ensuring the U.S. Constitution only ensures, you know, our national security. It only secures, you know, our international trade, those types of things. It's very limited. And if you create your state government in the same manner of limiting it to making sure that how it regulates or how it deals with the counties, let's not say regulate, how it should actually ensure that each county has the same commercial opportunities and advantages. But bottom line, any problems within that state are state court issues. And so this, if people got smart on the Constitution and placed real context, that this thing is a power of attorney. When we really look at it, these constitutions are powers of attorney of what we're delegating power to. And boy, as soon as we start looking at it that way, then we can actually start creating the appropriate, I'll just say, start distributing the appropriate powers to where they really belong. Does the state really need all of those types of powers? No. The county should have all of these powers. Here's a question. Should you have the ability in a state for a sparsely populated county to have equal representation in your legislature with a more populated county? Most people would say under the paradigm of democracy, no. Well, why was the Senate, so sacred that states had equal representation and that the state legislatures were guaranteed suffrage in the Senate, that they couldn't lose their equal representation in the Senate without their consent? So my point is, folks, is that we should actually be framing our state constitutions in the idea, and most of them kind of fell backwards into this. In other words, they kind of did it right based on following the model that they could understand. We can clean this up. How do we clean this up? And this is probably the million-dollar question. How do we clean this up? So most people out there, they all have their own little solutions. Oh, it's common law. Oh, no, it's the sheriff. Oh, no, it's going to be, what's the next thing out there? The jural assemblies, the sovereign citizens. Oh, no, it's a democracy. Every citizen should have equal say of whether they're going to comply or not. I mean, That's actually anarchy. That's a democracy driven with anarchy, anarchical principles. But the fact of the matter is, when we break it all down, the only way we're going to actually educate people on all of the principles of the Constitution is help them understand what the Constitution really says and what it's supposed to be doing. So how do you do that? How do you educate everybody on the Constitution? Well, we have a color-coded Constitution, and it's free. And you can go through that, and reading the color-coded Constitution, those colors represent parts of the Constitution that are being violated. In other words, this little clause, this highlighted area in this color-coded Constitution, this is this type of, you know, violation. And there's different degrees of violations. That's why there's different colors. Super egregious with the, you know, red with yellow lettering. Really super bad is red with black lettering. And then, you know, you've got yellow. And then you have the, I think there's a green color. But it's all in the key at the very top. But look at that Constitution and then start looking at how it's being violated. And now you can actually say, well, shoot, I don't know how it's being violated. I just see the areas that are being violated. How do you start understanding how those parts are being violated? Because when we get our arms around the problem, you can't solve a problem if you don't understand it. You can put a Band-Aid on it, but nobody wants to tell you this. This is why when it comes to listening to all of these so you have, I'm going to take an aside here and kind of explain something. You've already heard me talk at the beginning of the show about conservative entertainers. Conservative entertainers are not really highly educated. They're smart people. They articulate. I'll give you a good example. Candace Owens. She's an entertainer. She's really smart. She says really smart stuff, but she doesn't really understand the Constitution. When you start getting into the nuts, you lift that hood up and you start getting into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution. What is this supposed to do? And what does this mean? And so forth. You know, she doesn't understand it that much. But that doesn't matter. She can make some really good, you know, she connects with the audience. So she's a great entertainer, but she's not what I would call a preacher of the Constitution. And there is the next spotlight of groups of people we have. So now we have conservative entertainers, and over in this other group here, we have the preachers of the Constitution. Now, there are those preachers out there that basically preach the annotated Constitution. That's what you'll find in the progressive circles. And those are the people that really believe, and actually there's quite a few that believe in this quote-unquote constitutional law. And I'm smiling because there's no such thing. There is no such thing as constitutional law. There are laws that are in pursuance to the Constitution, and there are laws that are not. In other words, we have constitutional laws, and we have unconstitutional laws, but we do not have constitutional law. In other words, we don't have this form of law like contract law. That is a, you know, something you have to understand, contract law, like collateral estoppel. What does collateral estoppel mean? It's a fundamental principle of contract law. So there's these different principles that, you know, kind of beget this type of law, these standards and so forth. And so when we look at the form of law as constitutional law, That is an aggrandizement by jurists and lawyers and the legal club to basically say, you have to understand, you know, case law precedents and the way we have basically massaged these rulings and this paradigm to fit into what we have created as a living constitution. So this is those of the annotated constitution that believe that the constitution is a lie for the jurists to constantly make decisions and law, which they have no authority, which we made a petition to do to shut that down. So there's that camp on the constitutional preachers. Now you have, as you start moving away from the progressive, because really that's the progressive bastion, and that is the norm, you know, when we look at, you know, this concept of constitutional law, we look at the living constitution, that is the camp of the progressives. Now you start moving a little bit closer to constitutionalism when you start moving away from that. But there are way too many people that are preachers of the Constitution that accept many things of the Constitution that are not constitutional, or I should say many laws, many parts of government that are not constitutional. There are some people that, you know, as we go into this preaching, there are some people that have maintained a monarchical form of government, principles and structure of government. And I'll give you a good example. Jural assemblies, common law grand juries being invoked by the people. The concept that the sheriff is the most powerful person in your county. Not at all. As a matter of fact, your county, every county in this union has been improperly established, or I should say instituted, under the new principles under the Constitution, because every county should have a separations of powers. It should have three branches of government, or three little factions, if you don't want to call them branches, that's maybe too big, but you have a judiciary, you have an executive, and you have a legislative, and all legislative power goes to your representatives. It's simple, folks. So, and the reason I brought all of this up, because now here's my challenge, I got about 6 minutes left. The reason I'm kind of started off on all of this was because the conversation has come up, and it's actually circling around in my, I'll just say, the camp where I'm working with people, connecting people together and so forth. And there has been this, you know, this would be great. This would be really good to have GR start debating with a lot of these different people. And some of these people are lawyers. Some of these people are conservative preachers, I should say, preachers on the Constitution, but they've never read the ratification debates. And they don't understand this concept of this power of attorney. They don't understand this limited and defined. They don't look at the Constitution based on the framers defining it. Folks, this is the huge abyss between yours truly and all the other constitutional preachers out there. There are so many that actually dive into and they find themselves, you know, reaching out. It's kind of like when you swim in a pool and you have a real ledge that is founded on the Constitution, and then there's these pseudo ledges that are founded on monarchical government or democracy, things that are not constitutional. I'll give you a good case in point. There should never be, and there should not be, any state in this union that allows voter initiatives or allows voters to pass laws. The problem isn't the need for that. The problem is that your state legislature has created laws that they don't have the power to do. They're enforcing laws that they don't have. The other problem is, and there, this becomes like this death spiral, is that there's every state in the union ratifies, or I should say, amends their constitution based on principles of democracy. In other words, they're not done based on the model of the Constitution, where it requires a certain set of counties, or in the federal Constitution, states, but in your county, in your state, it should be counties. In other words, it shouldn't be 50% of the counties. It should be a marked advantage. In other words, 2/3 of the counties to amend the Constitution. Why? Why? Because it should be difficult to make changes when smart men get together and say, hey, this is how we're going to confine and limit our government. Then when all of a sudden people say, well, we want to give government the ability to give us bread. Okay, well, that's not smart. And that's why to make that kind of change, you should have a supermajority, not a mob rule. And the reason why a supermajority of counties, now see, I did open Pandora's box, by the way, because, or I should say, I opened up, maybe a can of whoop butt, right? When I talk about L.A. County subdividing and some of the other cities, municipalities subdividing, then that's great, right? Yeah, but what ends up happening is that it begs the requirement to subdivide the state. Because L.A. can be an island in itself just like Singapore. In other words, Chicago can be an island of itself just like Singapore. Many of these, because I've been a huge advocate of letting these metropolis areas serve themselves. They want to tax themselves into better public transportation. They want to do those types of things. As long as what they do is not violating the state constitution or the U.S. Constitution, then there you go. But I'm going to tell you, they can't do a lot of those things if the constitutions don't allow them to do that. Like creating a welfare system. They shouldn't be able to create a welfare system. They shouldn't be able to implement socialism or those types of things where they provide to the people other than, and this is why we need to actually go into the state constitutions and literally delineate what type of services that we want the state government to have. Because right now the federal government has assumed powers that they shouldn't have, but we can't leave it to a free market. We can't leave your freeway system to a free market because you can't build roads and you can't afford to do that. And the guy in your community that can't afford to do that is not going to do it to your advantage. So we actually have to be smart. And we actually, and I don't think it's really smart. I just think that if we have the spirit with us, if we pray and fast and we're really putting everything on the table, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. So back to this debate. You know, I'm not looking to take advantage of people because I have an advantage. What I would much rather do is I'd much rather see these preachers actually come and, you know, come objectively, because the last thing I want to do is drag somebody along and rub their nose in their vomit. You know, like that's... You can kind of train a dog that way, but that's not a good way to train a dog. There's much better ways to train a dog. And there's much better ways to help people break through their paradigms and actually broadening their paradigm and shifting their paradigm to actually seeing the Constitution the way the Lord, our Creator, had designed it. Because many of these people have an opportunity to really be doing the right thing, and they're just not. They're actually misleading people. They're making and supporting arguments that are, you know, that aren't helping the issue. They're not really clarifying the issue. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Thank you so much for listening. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution.
So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.